Hello, a very good Saturday morning. You're very welcome along to the weekend edition here on Highland Radio with me, Greg Hughes. Hope we find you very well indeed. Coming up on today's show, we'll be joined in studio shortly by Finbar Doherty to discuss an upcoming performance of Across the Water, a very interesting story indeed. Have you ever thought of writing a book but wouldn't know where to start? Well, an expert will join us with some tips. They do say everyone has a book in them, of course. Kelly Sweeney is representing the Wild Atlantic Way at this year's Mary from Dunloe Festival. She'll join us in the studio later to discuss that. Some aren't happy at girls as young as seven wearing adult clothes. It's an issue we'll discuss. And the Knotty Pine Band's in studio to play some live music for us later. And we discuss what's coming up in the cinema with Daniel from Eclipse Cinema, who'll also be giving away some free passes. So all that between now and 12 and more as well. We also want your calls, comments and requests to the usual numbers 086 77 00 555 if you want to text us on your mobile. Marion's taking your calls today on 0749 125 000, or if you're on Twitter, you can tweet me directly at Greg Hughes too. A quick look at what you'll find on the front of the newspapers if you're out buying one this morning. Starting with the Irish Times, solicitor named over disputed NAMA fees. This is off the back of revelations made in the Dáil during the week. Well, one of the leading business figures in Northern Ireland, Ian Coulter, was named yesterday as the partner who left a Belfast law firm in a dispute over allegedly diverted fees linked to NAMA's largest asset sale. Belfast law firm Toon said Mr. Coulter was involved in the sale by NAMA last year of a portfolio of loans with a nominal value of $5.7 billion, which was sold for $1.6 billion. Most of the loans were linked to property in Northern Ireland. Mick Wallace, of course, made allegations in the Dáil as it relates to those or that fund, or at least a portion of that fund being redirected to the Isle of Man. Yes side takes narrow lead ahead of the Greek vote. Obviously things on a knife edge, almost quite literally, in Greece. A vote tomorrow on whether to accept European proposals. Well, Greek voters go to the polls tomorrow in a historic referendum that could determine their country's future in the single currency after the state's highest administrative court gave the green light for the referendum to go ahead. The Irish Daily Mail, they focus on issues at home. The town's abandoned by doctors for over 2 years. Apparently, there are at least 10 isolated rural communities being left without the services of a family doctor. This according to the Irish Daily Mail. Last night, the HSE in action was criticised as it emerged that three such areas had not had a full-time GP for over 2 years. Independent focuses on the Greece crisis. Locals and holidaymakers alike in Greece will be unable to buy food or medicine within days if a deal is not reached to reopen the banks, business leaders have warned. But coming out of the country, the country's leaders say that they have stockpiled fuel and they have put away some reserves to buy basics if required. The Irish Daily Star, 180k MAM scam. This is a man who raked in a whopping €180,000 after fraudulently claiming his dead mother's pension for 16 years after she had died. Brian Bobby is to stand trial accused of stealing the massive six-figure sum from the Department of Social Protection. Irish Daily Mirror, tears of grief on her birthday. For some reason, pictures of funerals and people mourning and pictures of coffins sell papers. I can't understand why, but they clearly do, or else they wouldn't be on the front page. A nation rallied around the only child of murdered Martina and Lawrence Hayes yesterday. She buried her parents on her 31st birthday. This is, of course, the Irish victims of the Tunisian massacre being laid to rest. Crazed fanatic, that's what a priest described the person who's responsible for the deaths of Larry and Martina Hayes. The crazed brainwashed fanatic of Islamic State have landed on Ireland's doorstep, a priest told mourners. The couple were gunned down by Sefedin Rescue in last week's beach massacre. So that's just a flavour of what's on the front of the papers this Saturday morning. 086 77 00 555 is the text line, or call us 0749 125 000. Back with our first guest in studio after this break. Okay, you're very welcome back to the weekend edition. I'm joined in studio now by Finbar Doherty. Finbar, thank you so much for coming in this Saturday morning.
Glad to be here, thank you.
And we're talking about Across the Water, which is a performance which is coming up in the Regional Culture Centre on Thursday the 9th of... that's next Thursday,
that's
isn't
next
it?
Thursday coming.
At 8pm. We'll talk more about that in a moment. I understand you were going to perform for us live, but you've got a little bit of a...
I was advised by my daughter driving up here, definitely do not sing this morning.
Well, you need to protect your voice.
We need to protect my voice, but she said it wouldn't sound very good on air. We won't subject your listeners to...
daughters are sometimes too honest.
Yeah, I know.
But
I
anyway, we have some music from you, which we'll listen to later in any case. Tell us about Across the Water and its origins.
Okay, right. It goes back to a book that was published that originally came from Clonmany about a guy called Charlie McGlinchey. Now, there was a school teacher back in the 1950s, a man by the name of Patrick Kavanagh. He met this old character called Owen McGlinchey, Charlie McGlinchey, who was born in 1861. And he was a great raconteur of all the old history, the stories that his father had told him. And so he had anecdotes going back to the Napoleonic Wars. So Patrick Kavanagh spotted this, took him in, and by shorthand, he just took down all the old stories.
So it was like a walking history book, but it had to be archived or else it would have been lost with him.
You're absolutely right. It had to be archived. And that's what Patrick Kavanagh did. So, but he ended up with this massive collection of stories that didn't really order to it.
And there's no narrative
coming through it. So Des Kavanagh, his son, who lives in Galway and is still very active with the whole McGlinchey sort of history, took it to Brian Friel, the playwright. And Brian Friel put the stuff into a sort of
And Brian Friel's not a person that would give of his time willy-nilly, so he obviously saw something of great potential in this.
Absolutely. Well, that's exactly... He saw the potential in it immediately. Mm. And Seamus Heaney then saw it as well, and he said, "Yeah, this is a gem. This is a gem from a part of Inishowen and Donegal, a very rural area, that should be preserved and documented." Mm. So the what resulted in that was a book. Actually, I meant to take it with me, and I don't have it in front of me here.
But it's a
beautiful little book. It's the sort of book you could pick it up at any point. It's a real page turner.
The coffee table book, isn't it? What they call
totally.
It, sort of thing,
but you know, if you started reading it, you'd be inclined.
You wouldn't put it down,
and the coffee would go cold. You'd probably finish the book. It's a very simple read, and it's done in the language of rural, Inishowen, Donegal. So that's what resulted in it, and the book became the last of the name.
Mm.
The name coming from the fact that he was called Charlie McGlinchey. And he always said when he passed away, he was the last of the name. He didn't get married or he didn't have any offspring. So that was the end of the McGlinchey name.
At the time, obviously, his knowledge and his stories was recognised by one person, obviously, because that's where we're at now.
Yeah.
Do we know how Charles McGlinchey was, in the community or the wider area generally, how he's received or how he was viewed?
I think, again, we have to rely on sort of anecdotes again. But I think he was everywhere. He would call into people's houses. He was a Caelier, so he had a lot of knowledge, and he was very parochial. He didn't seem to be aware of the bigger events like the World Wars, the stuff that happened outside of Donegal. So he was very much, I suppose you could say, insular to an extent. And so he was a well-known character. He was a well-known character in the area. And I suppose he just relayed news around the place.
And are all of the stories that he relayed factual?
They are factual.
Yes.
There's one story about he heard about a guy who was abducted by the fairies and taken off, and
yes, that's subjective, isn't it?
That is subjective. But there's other very, very real stories.
Yes.
There's real stories of a woman who climbed to the top of Pinch Mountain which is a mountain down in Clonmany. And this is back in the day, of course, when we put it in perspective.
Give us an idea of when we're talking here.
We're talking here back as far as the Napoleonic Wars, right. But memories going back that far, yes. right up to when Charles
sort of been handed down.
Down because his father was a weaver, and his father before him was a weaver, so they would have worked together. So these stories were really passed on. There was, for example, there's one story of a woman who climbed to the top of Pinch Mountain, and she looked across the Loch Swilly, and she was looking at Fanad, and the world was definitely a place where you probably didn't get as far as Derry,
yeah,
if you were lucky, because you had to walk. And she looked across, and she could see the mountains of Fanad, and she said, "Oh, that's America." She said, "That's America where all my loved ones went and never came back." You know, and that was the reality. That's how small
There's a nice innocence to that, isn't there?
Very much an innocence.
Yeah.
An innocence.
It's not ignorance, it's innocence.
It's absolutely innocence because, you know what, I mean, they didn't have all the technology that we have at our...
Of course.
You know, and something happens in Timbuktu now, we're aware of it in a few seconds, so it's a...
It's a challenge when you try and interpret someone else's work.
Yeah. I suppose the way this thing happened. Well, first of all, I'm a songwriter. That's what I do. And you tend to write out. You tend to write songs about what comes in onto your radar. You write when you're younger, you write about a broken heart, and then you get older, you write about, you know. So you're always looking for things. I ended up writing a song, and I think the first song I wrote was a called "Across the Water." I thought that's a great subject matter for a song, but then it just sort of mushroomed because that was the most important thing for me to write about at the time. This was back in 2007, which resulted in an album I recorded called "Across the Water." But to be honest, it was very, you know, that old cliche: the songs wrote themselves. They kind of did. It was the most important thing for me at that time to write about. And I think songwriters, that's what they don't always set out to write about a certain thing. It's kind of what happens. It's what comes down there.
Yeah.
Come down the turnpike or whatever, you know, the term is, you know. So that's how the album
and the "Across the Water." Is multimedia the way to describe it? It's I can't really think of the word. I mean, we're not talking computers here and what have you, but it's a multi-layered experience, different aspects.
Explain it
to us, because I'm doing a rubbish job.
Okay, not at all. No, you're doing good. You're doing good. The other aspect that we decided to do then, well, first of all, let me explain what the show, and it's going to, when I say multimedia, we have an actor on the night who basically becomes Charlie McGlinchey.
Mm-hmm.
He's taking on the character, an actor called Paul Kelly. I think he's worth seeing. So he gets inside the skin of Charlie McGlinchey, and he talks about basically the things that were going on in his head at the time. Now, the multimedia part comes because we had a girl, Margaret Farn, who's from Clonmany, who discovered lots of old photographs of the Clonmany area that were basically in a biscuit tin box under a bed in a house that was about to be demolished, you know. So they were old family. So we very kindly got the permission to use all this old archival photographs, and we dug them in, and we put them on a slide. So this has all been projected up. So basically, you're looking at rural Clonmany while you're listening to Charles McGlinchey, and you've also got the music. So we've three different mediums happening simultaneously, you know.
And you get a real true feel of, you know, I mean, like the pictures and the live performance of Charles McGlinchey fill in the blanks,
yes,
supposedly, and make it more of a more rounded experience.
Well, that's what we've
that's
tried.
What hope is.
That exactly. That's what we've tried to tie the whole lot together so that the photographs relate to the song, relate to what the subject of what Charles McGlinchey is referring to at that time. So it's very much tied together, and that took us a lot of time to do that. But it was a very, very. It's like, you know, when you open up a biscuit tin box with photographs, and you just start glancing at them, and suddenly like an hour passes and 2 hours pass, and you just seem to You know, it's like climbing up into the attic as a child, and you'd find old photographs and stuff, and you mightn't come down for a couple of hours, and you sort of do get lost in time. Well, even though this wasn't our own family, there's still great stories to be told from old photographs, and I think old photographs sometimes tell a very interesting story that maybe now with all the instant photographs that we have. They're not. I don't think they have the same. They didn't have selfie sticks and stuff.
Well, I don't think we're going to be putting. not most of us aren't going to be putting photographs in a biscuit tin, which is kind of
sad.
Yeah, because you wonder what was in the person's mind when they put them in the biscuit tin.
Totally.
Was it for future generations? Was it to store them?
Yeah,
you know. But
yeah. And a photograph, and you know yourself, if you look at your parents or your grandparents on a photograph, they got dressed up for the occasion.
Yeah.
They got into the Sunday suit and they would, you know, and they would have everything lined up. So it was very much an occasion because whereas now it's instant and it's not, you know, so.
It's lost its important. But having said that, there's still photographers out there doing great work, and maybe they're the ones that carry it on. But
definitely. I just hope that they don't all get lost in a flash stick you know.
Like I always thought it was a great advert. I can't remember which one of the companies it was, but it was just pictures around the house with that little folder box from the PC. Do you know what I mean?
That's right.
On the wall.
Yeah.
Which I thought I think it was for printing, for a printer or something.
That's right.
But I thought it was really clever the way
very
it was done.
Clever.
Right, okay, it's Thursday, July the 9th. Just one performance then, is it?
One performance. One
and it's
performance.
At 8 o'clock in the Regional Cultural Centre.
Yes.
And tickets just €10 or €6 accompanied child for free. What's the price variation there? Sorry, 10 to 6?
A very good question.
I have no clue.
I have no clue either. I think it's 10.
Prepare for 10 and you might be surprised by 6.
I should know all this stuff. I should know this stuff. I think it's €10 adults and maybe, is it €8, is it, for children?
I have no clue.
I think children are free with parents. I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But there's maybe 6 is concessions, you know?
Maybe that's what it is. Yeah.
It's not a long show, though, is it?
It's about 45-minute show.
Could have been longer. Why? Did you purposely want to keep it sort of concise?
To be honest, I'm a fan of shows that are kind of get in and do what they want to do and finish up. I've been to like rock concerts, you know, where some shows or acts would play for 4 hours. And to be honest, after 2 hours, I'm usually looking for a deck chair to sit down and put my feet up. I think that, you know, your attention span is good. So it's a 45-minute show.
Okay. Now, and you'll be in fine fettle by then too. I'm fully recovered.
Yes, I'll be in fine fettle. We'll have a band. When I say a band, we'll have Seamus Devaney and Lorna Henry, the Henry Girls.
Yes.
We'll have Paul Kelly, of course, and we'll have another couple of people operating the projector. Could I just maybe take this moment to talk to Margaret Farn, who was very much instrumental in this project. She provided all the photographs and did all the thing, and she's actually in Letterkenny Hospital at the moment. I'm just wishing her a good, speedy recovery. I don't know if she'll make it for the show. Yeah.
Well, someone will tell her that you mentioned her. You can be sure of that if she's not listening herself.
I got my daughter to text her on the way up just to get her to make
good
sure to tune in. So that's Margaret Farn there.
Okay.
You're doing
special mention for her. Yeah, now, we're going to play a track from you. It's actually Across the Water, isn't it? This is the one you wrote back in.
Yeah. Now you can choose whichever.
We'll go with Across the Water, I think.
Yeah. Well, now that Across the Water actually does feature Lorna. So.
Last of the Name. We agreed on, didn't we? Yeah. Tell us Last of the Name.
Okay. The Last of the Name. Let me fill you in a little bit. By the way, Across the Water was the song I intended to sing as well. I wouldn't have done as good a job as Lorna on it. Last of the Name. Charlie McGlinchey talks about coming back. He said, my time in this world has kind of come to an end. He said, when I go, I'll be the last of the name. I'll be gone. But he said, my friends have all gone ahead of me. I mean, and they did believe in the afterlife, and they did believe in all. And he said, when I go, I know who'll be waiting for me up there. And he said, as good friends, Eileen, Evelyn, and Owen will be up there. And he said, if they came back here today. He said they wouldn't, after an hour would do them, he said they'd want to go back up again. He talks about like the cars and the buses and the silk stockings and all the style. He said an hour would do them and they'd want to go back to the other place. Perfect. So it's a sort of a very final ending, but a very, there's great resignation in it.
Okay, that's the voice there of Finbarr Doherty talking about Cross the Water, which is taking place at the Regional Cultural Centre in Letterkenny on Thursday, July 9th. That's next Thursday at 8 p.m. And this is his track called Last of the Name.
All the people I know are gone. My time in this world is traveling on. All the people I know are gone. Away. And if Eileen or Daisy could see on a Sunday afternoon what I can see, the silk stockings and style, with cars and buses driving by. All the people I know are gone away. And I wonder, what would they do? What were they think the world was coming to? I don't think they'd stay. In an hour or two, they'd be on their way. All the people I know are gone away.
And you're very welcome back. Anne-Marie asks, did your guest say there was a book written by Charlie McGlinchey? No, there wasn't a book written by him, but his stories and what have you were archived. And then there was a book, a memoir, which was edited by Brian Friel, and it's called The Last of the Name. So if you want to check that out, I'm sure you can track it down somewhere. Sean Quinn joins us in studio now. Sean, how are you?
I'm grand.
Thank you so much for coming in, because you're a very busy man. You organised the Quinn Gathering, which kicked off last night.
Yes, last night we launched the Quinn Gathering. We had the Quinn Gathering 2 years ago, and this is the second Quinn Gathering. The Quinn Gathering was a result of research I conducted into the Quinn and related families of Convoy. And this sort of all started for me nearly 50 years ago. I was born in Clonglash, just outside Buncrana. Mm-hmm. And I used to wander in and out of houses talking to the old people, because my father was very interested in family connections. And the best I could do was to wander in and out, talk to the old people, and put together all the connections between the families of Clonglash, Keelux and Bavel.
Were you doing that for yourself, or for the family, or for your father?
I think I was doing it for myself. It's just my father was kept talking about it. But then on the Quinn side, we always understood from my father that we were from Ballindrate. This was because my great-great-great-grandfather lived in Ballindrate in 1900. But I did a bit of research and found that my great-great-grandfather was born in Godnescale Convoy in 1866. And the reason that we didn't have that connection to Convoy was that he died at 37 years of age. So all they knew about the family was the mother's side. They didn't know about the Quinn side. Yeah. So I came up here in 82 to teach in the Institute of Technology. And as soon as I had a chance, I wandered out to
Was that a happy coincidence?
I suppose it was, you see. I always wanted to...
Well, that's it. I'm trying to say, were you always somewhat drawn here? Or
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, I was always drawn to Donegal. We spent every summer in Donegal. Mm. I was born here. My sister Mary was born here. And my father always wanted to come back in the event.
Now, there are a few gatherings that take place around, and the Quinn gatherings, this is its third or second year?
No, this is the second time.
Second year. And what is the motivation behind these gatherings, or what's the aim? I'm asking that question from pure ignorance, if you know what I mean. What, do you put the call out and say, look, are you an ancestor of this Quinn? Is it open to all Quinns? How do you go about organising something like this?
What happens is, in my case, I just go about the place knocking on doors.
Simple as that.
As simple as that. You call on someone who has never met you before, and you start asking them very personal questions. And anyway,
it's a nice breaker, I suppose.
You go from house to house, and the word gets out about you.
Yeah.
And so I started that in 82, 83. And then I was coming up to retirement in 2012. So a few years before that, I sort of started it again. And I called, you hear about people who may have a Quinn connection or may not. You get in contact with them. And I got in contact with someone called Ambrose Givern. His mother was Quinn. And I visited him. And he suggested I visit somebody else. And I visited the somebody else.
Are you sure you just don't like visiting?
I do like visiting people in Donegal and chatting about these type of things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I was sort of ambushed by a group of people who proceeded to tell me who they were.
Right.
And then I proceeded to tell them who exactly they were, because they didn't really have much of a clue.
Amazing.
So they suggested we have a meeting. So we had about a half a dozen meetings. And I suggested, as I was coming up to retirement, we have a gathering. Now, this was supposed to be 2012. And then the government stole my idea. So I moved it to 2013. And then that sort of was very successful. And they didn't want to let go. So here we are again.
It's become an annual. And it launched last night.
Well, last night in the Institute of Technology, I took advantage of my former employer and used the facility.
Is he a Quinn, no?
No, not at all. No connection. No connection. But there's a lot of people connected to an awful lot of people, and they don't realise it. And this is what I've discovered in the past few weeks.
And obviously, just with the nature of our country and our history, the Quinns obviously spread out right across the world, I presume.
Well, you know, in the case of most Irish families, they more or less remained in the place where they began.
Right.
And the name Quinn originated in these parts around the 12th, 13th century. In East Donegal, Ma Ita, North Raphoe, and they have remained there. Now, clearly, an awful lot of people emigrated, so we have connections everywhere.
Mm. Now, the turnout, is it growing?
I wouldn't say that. I probably told them too much 2 years ago.
You've used up all your material. Yeah.
Well, 2 years ago, you see, there's an absence of paper documentation, mm-hmm. if you go back a few hundred years. So in the convoy area, there were three families, and all three families bore the same personal Christian names. All three families were scutchers of flax. And I decided that they were related. And I also worked out how they were related, but I'd no documentation to prove that. And now I've sort of taken the DNA route, and it's proven.
Really?
Really and
truly. So how did you make the connection without documentation? I mean, what system were you using?
Well, the system is quite simple. My name, I'm called Sean Quinn.
Yes.
I was baptised John after my grandfather. He was John.
Yeah.
And I have a brother, Connell. He's called after his grandfather, Con McLaughlin.
Right.
I have a brother, Donal. He's called after my father.
Yeah.
You know, people were called after
just
people.
Just logic, really, I suppose.
You see?
Logic point from that time, yeah.
So you get you get a hold of a family, you look at the names, and the names will tell you who the grandparents are or give you an indication. And then you have to find documentation that ties in with that.
This is not unique to your own name and your own family. You have a general interest in Irish ancestry, and you've written a number of books, haven't you? And you also work, which I suppose has changed things a great deal now, in that you work online, which I think opens it up perhaps even more and takes a bit of the footwork out of it.
Well, actually, 15 years ago, I established a website called 15 years ago. A website called IrishAncestors.net.
I mean, you were right on the...
I was on the cutting edge of it. But if you went onto my website, you wouldn't be too impressed.
No.
Everything you want is there. But it's not very sexy. It's just basic tables. But my whole idea is that anyone, anywhere in the world, should have open and free access to what is available. And the reality now is, right now, you can trace your family tree online. And you can do that more or less for free. And on Wednesday, the National Library of Ireland is placing the records, the parish records, online. So we can get the census records online, the parish records online. We can get the index to the vital records, birth, marriages and death. We can get Griffith's land valuation. We can get the tight allotment books. So you can flash back to about the 70s, 90s, more or less at no cost. And if you want a certificate, go into your local registry of births, and they should charge you no more than €4 for a copy, a research copy of a marriage certificate that goes back to 1864.
Excuse me. It's hugely interesting because there's a lot of people make a lot of money out of this.
I'm afraid that's true. Unfortunately, I'm one of them who's losing money on it.
Yeah. remember when they released the census documents? Was it the 1912 census that they released them?
No, the census in the 26 counties for 1901.
Was it 1901?
Because and 1911.
Yeah, because it was 19. I was 1 year out. Give me a break, Sean. Yes. No, because I remember searching my great grandmother, and it was astonishing just to be able to see in the computer who was in the house at that time
and see their signature or their mark. In most cases in Donegal, it was a mark because they couldn't read or write,
and what they were described as, you know, there's some really
well, there were spinsters, bachelors, their occupations, where they were,
and people who worked on the farm. I can't recall what they were called, but it seemed, in this day and age, it seemed somewhat derogatory, but at that time,
I mean, there are terms like imbecile, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But it's amazing how times change. How long to go now for the Quinn gathering?
Well, tonight we're having a dinner in the Mount Errigal Hotel, and anyone who's connected is welcome to come along. If they go on to seanquinn.com, they'll find contact details on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be talking a little bit about the DNA results that we've just got.
Was it hard to get people to cooperate with that?
It was very hard to get people to cooperate because it costs money. Yeah. You see?
Did you not foot the bill, no?
I footed a tiny bit of the bill, and I've paid more than anybody else.
Yeah.
But at the minute, you can get what's called an autosomal DNA test for $89. Now, that cost €66 a couple of months ago. Now it costs about €83.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Look, it's hugely interesting. Where can people get hold of your books? Because, as I say, you've got I've got in front of me the Introduction to Irish Ancestry, which you said I can keep, which I'm going to read. You've got your website, IrishAncestors.net, 15 years old, before Facebook and Twitter, it has to be.
That is true, yes.
Yeah. IrishSurnames.net, and your own personal website, which is probably the best place to go because then everything branches off.
Yes.
That's
SeanQuinn.com.
Plain and simple. Know. And if you can't spell Quinn, you've no business going on that website.
No business. But it should be mentioned that most of the people there will not be called Quinn because they're Quinn and related families.
I had an aunt who lived in England. She wanted to research the family tree. She arrived on a holiday in Donegal, and I said, "Well, Auntie, how are you getting on with the family tree?" Her reply was, "I got as far as two generations and left it at that. Is there people who end up finding out things they want to?" I presume that means, like, sort of, if you look back in your history, maybe you sort of say, "Right, I've had enough." I don't know. Hello, Greg. I had a Quinn in my family tree on both sides. I'd love to ask that man some questions. Could I get his contact number, please? See, this is what happens, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, if he goes on to SeanQuinn.com, there's an email address there, quinngathering at gmail.com.
Another texter says, "Hi, this man's very interesting. My grandmother was Quinn from the manor. And well done to Sean E. Quinn. Was lovely to meet him 2 years ago from your cousin, third, Cora Harvey, granddaughter, and Frank Quinn in Convoy.
Right, right, okay.
Okay, so there you go. Right, so the Mount Argyle tonight.
That's it, 7:30. Details, SeanQuinn.com. I don't know if I could relax, I'd look forward to it, but I'm not a relaxing person, I'm afraid.
No, you do seem a little, not the type that's going to put your feet up and smoke a cigar. Yes. But Sean, thank you so much for coming in and explaining that to us. I wish you had more time. Yes. But it's been great chatting to you, and best of luck with the rest of the gathering.
Okay, thank you very much.
Now, have you ever thought of writing a book? Well, fully qualified author, a best-selling author, Donna Kennedy's on the programme with us now. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Very well. Let me ask you, first of all, Donna, does everybody have a book in them, or is that a myth?
Well, I think everybody has a book in them. About 85% of people look for, you know, they want to write a book at some point in their life. And I do believe everyone has a book in them. Maybe they don't feel as confident to put it out there, or maybe they don't feel they're clever enough or that kind of thing. But really, I do believe that everybody has a book in them.
But if you're writing a book, should you always maybe be thinking about, what I'm trying to say is, should you write what you feel, or is the mistake people make they try and write for commercial success?
Well, I think really it's important that that you think of something that publishing is a business. So therefore, if you send it to a publisher, a lot of people, you know, they get offended if they get their manuscript rejected. And the reason for that is they believe, you know, this is exactly as you said, you know, that they write what they feel, they believe in it, and so on. But that's not necessarily something that's going to make a publisher money. And a publisher is, they are a business, and therefore they'll only take on things that they believe will make the money. So you have to have a commercial sense to it.
Yeah, that's the practical side of things. I don't read, if I'm completely honest with you, I don't read any novels or what have you. Would that preclude me from being able to write a book? How to structure a book? How would I go about doing that?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, you're certainly able to do it. If you can talk, you can write. That's the way I look at it. You don't have to be extremely clever, and you don't have to be exceptionally good at grammar. At the end of the day, editors are for that. All you have to do is have an idea and make sure that you structure correctly. That's a three-part process. I actually teach a course on this, but it's a three-part process. First of all, you have to prepare your manuscript, and then you have to obviously write it, and then you have to sell it. And it's very important that people understand that. Again, if you have a book, anyone can write a book and you can get it put together, and then you can put it on your shelf and feel proud of yourself and everything, which is a fantastic achievement. But if you want to make sales, you have to be thinking about what is it that will sell. And therefore, you have to write. First of all, you have to see, is there a market for it? And then you have to look at ways to sell it. And there certainly are ways that you can make a book bestseller. You need to follow those if you want your book to be a success.
Now, I've come up with an idea of a book about some fellow, not literally, but say, for example, I've come up with some fellow who gets marooned on a desert island. So that's the basic concept of it. Is that where I should start writing from, or do you need to have some idea of a middle, a beginning and an end before you really start putting pen to paper, at least metaphorically speaking?
You 100% have to have a beginning, a middle and an end. And this is, a lot of people actually come to me with some of their book already written. Mm. Now, they start off and they have a great idea, and then they get to chapter 3 and they've got all their great information out, and they go, well, what next? And they lose track, or they go off on a totally different tangent. I think it's very important that you structure your manuscript. And really, people need to understand that the book is not about you. It's actually about the reader. So unless the reader has structure, psychologically we all love, you know, reading things that make sense, reading things that we can absorb and accept and feel that we understand. It's like if you're in a conversation with somebody and they talk jargon, you just want to switch off, and you're not going to recommend other people talk to them. It's the exact same for a book. You have to have a book structured. It has to be a logical sequence so that when someone turns the page, that's what makes sense to come next. May not necessarily be what you accept or expect, should I say, in, for example, a thriller or so on. But you need to have the book structured in a way that the reader can understand it, that they don't feel that you're talking at them, that they feel that you're talking with them and you're enjoying the book with them. And that's whether that is fiction or non-fiction. The book is essentially about the reader. So therefore, you have to write your book in a certain way so that the reader feels satisfied once reading it. And then at the end of it, they say, that was a fantastic book. I'm recommending it to a friend. And then that's two sales, not just one.
You talked earlier about publishing and how we publish. In music, a lot of people now are releasing the music themselves or through certain websites rather than sort of the traditional way through a record company. Is it similar in the writing world?
Well, the writing, it is and it isn't, in that anybody can write a book and shove it online. And the problem with online is a fantastic way to promote your book, and it's basically you have an online campaign and you have an offline campaign when it comes to sales. But the problem with online books, a lot of them are, and for anyone who doesn't know what they're called, they're e-books. And an e-book are often given away for free with when people sign up to somebody's website or when they buy something and so on. So they've kind of lost value. So, you know, a book can be put online and somebody says, well, are you an author? Yeah. And you say, yes, I am. And they say, well, where can I find your book? Well, it's an e-book online. It doesn't offer that same credibility as if you have it in print. And people do, they do look for your book. You'll have it online as well, if you have to maximise sales. So my books, obviously, they're online. People across the world can buy them. And that's really important that you have that. But essentially, most people want that credibility behind it. And that's what the beauty of having a publisher is. They're saying you're good. You're not just saying you're good, if that makes sense.
It does make perfect sense. We're out of time, Donna. How can people get more information?